This is BFBS,
the Forces Station.
The story of the Smiths.
I was happy in the haze of a drunken hour, but heaven knows I'm miserable now. I was looking for a job and then I found a job, and heaven knows I'm miserable now. In my life, why do I give valuable time to people who don't care if I live or die? Pass me by, and heaven knows I'm miserable now. I was looking for a job and then I found a job, and heaven knows I'm miserable now. In my life, oh, why do I give valuable time to people who don't care if I... of me at the end of the day, Caligula would have blushed. Oh, you've been in the house too long, she said, and I naturally fled. In my life, why do I smile at people who I'd much rather kick in the eye? I was happy in the haze of a drunken hour, but heaven knows I'm miserable now. Oh, you've been in the house too long, she said, and I naturally fled.
Heaven knows I'm miserable now, one of the iconic sounds of the Smiths, one that inspired a generation. I'm delighted to have alongside me Mike Joyce, who's going to take me through the highs and the lows of what it was like to be with the band.
BFBS, original music specials.
The story of the Smiths.
Great to hear another northern voice as well. Do you still live up that way?
I do, yeah. Just south of Manchester. Well, I was going to say I lived here all my life, but I didn't. In about 1980. Late 84, 85, Morrissey moved down to London and Johnny followed him pretty much at the same time. Morrissey moved to, I think, Kensington, and Johnny moved to World's Court. And myself and Andy thought, well, we're going to have to move down. Yeah. So we did. When I say unfortunately, we moved in a less salubrious area than Kensington. We were staying in a place called Willesden, which, I mean, I had no idea even where Willesden was, you know, Rough Trade sorted the accommodation out and we got down there and it was quite far out. So we moved then to Hampstead and I was like, oh, wow, Hampstead, very posh, you know, right at the pulse. It's not. It's bleeding miles outside of London. And at the time, you know, the tubes around that time stopped, you know, at 11 o'clock, 12 o'clock. So getting a taxi back to Hampstead was a dear do. But I've never wanted to leave Manchester, really. It's got everything that I've ever wanted. And people say, oh, it's always raining and it's cold. You know, that's called the seasons. I like to live the seasons, you know. I'm not a lizard. I don't want to go and live in a country where it's just hot for 365 days a year. I like the idea of snuggling up with the fire on and, well, I used to be able to put the fire on. Now it's just a big jumper with the cost of living.
Well, we've got our first tune, How Soon Is Now, that gorgeous haunting riff at the start of it. It gets me every single time. What are your memories of that track, Mike?
Yeah, well, do you know what? It gets me every time as well. And when I do a bit of DJing every now and again. And when I do play that, it just sounds so great in a club. It really does. And, you know, it's weird to think that it is, you know, 30-odd years old, because it still sounds as relevant today when I play it as when we recorded it. When we did record it, we wanted that swampy feeling. We took all the... I remember in the studio lighting was a bit naff. So we took the bulbs out and put some red bulbs in. And it just had a feeling like, it looked like a photography studio, actually, at a dark room. But just that, giving us that feel of that ugly, filthy, swampy kind of sound that we wanted. What an intro.
The story of the Smiths.
I know this is a bit of a big question. Could you give us a sort of a rundown on the very early days of the Smiths?
Yeah, I was sharing a flat with a lad, a mate of mine called Pete Hope. He had a mate called Johnny Marr, and he told me that this lad Johnny was looking for a drummer for this band that he was getting together. Did I fancy going down and having a play? And I said, yeah, okay, let's have a listen. So they sent me the cassette and I listened to it. And I thought, wow, that sounds pretty good. So Went down to a place in Manchester, in Tariff Street. There was the original bass player. Dale was there at the time, not Andy, and Morrissey and Johnny. And I'd seen Johnny a few times before. I'd seen him in there. He used to work in a shop called X Clothes in Manchester, and looking painfully cool. Absolutely, like, unapproachable. That cool, where you just think, my God, look at him. How cool does he look? First time I met Morrissey, very few words spoken between me and Morrissey. Johnny was... kind of conducting the whole thing, really, and had a little bit of a play with him. Didn't really speak to Morrissey at all, but what I heard, it sounded really good, but I was playing with a band, another band at the time called Victim from Northern Ireland, and they were good mates of mine, which has always happened when I've been in a band. You know, that kind of friendship thing has to be pretty strong for me to actually enjoy the experience of being with the band. I was torn. I wasn't too sure about leaving Victim because, like I said, I was seeing them as mates all the time. And Johnny was saying, come on, you got to join the band. You got to join the band. It'll be brilliant. Miles better than Victim. We're going to, you know, smash the world. And after a few weeks, I thought, you know, I think he's right. He's right. I can't deny that. They sound pretty good, these guys. So that was it. I joined the band. And the rest, they say, is history. I mean, we played our first gig. It was October 4th. 1982. And again, that was with Dale, with the original bass player, supporting Blue Rondo a la Turk at the Ritz in Manchester, which is still there. The only building in Manchester that the Smiths played at is still there, apart from the Palace Theatre. Anyway, that was it then. I was in.
The bands you sort of coming in from before had that sort of more of a punk influence coming from it, a bit more of a punk drummer. What was it like going in for what Johnny Marr was writing at the time and going into the band as the Smiths was early doors from the punk influence?
Yeah, I mean, some of it was tough. I mean, what difference does it make, the early recordings or the early rehearsals of it, and what Miserable Lie? You know, they were quite punky kind of tunes. Anyway, I made them quite a lot punkier than I think Johnny probably envisaged, but they were tough. I made them sound tough. That's what I did. And somebody sent me an early recording, actually, probably from 84, of a gig that we did in, I think, Edge Hill College, it might be, in Liverpool. It's everything's fast, everything's punky, and everything's got an edge. But obviously, when it came down to songs like I Don't Owe You Anything, Reel Around the Fountain, I struggled with them at first because I'd never played songs that tempo. I mean, my tempos were fast, faster, and the fastest. And those were the three tempos that you get out of me at the time. It was a real baptism of fire to have to learn to play a very different style of playing that I'd ever done before. I've not been playing like 20 years. I mean, I've only been playing since about 15, 16. So, you know, I was only, 19 myself. So it was, you know, it wasn't as though I could pull all my reserves out from playing with bands that played that slower tempo kind of song. I didn't have any. So I kind of had to learn how to play those songs. And again, it was a very different, and learn them quickly because, you know, once a riff's given to you, you can't say, oh, I can't play anything to that. That's not much fun for anybody, is it? I don't think I would have been around for much longer. So I had to adapt. But I found it quite difficult at first just because it was just not my style of playing.
Because for me, I look back and see the four of you together and it's just incredibly talented. It was written in the stars that you were always going to do this. Did you know you were going to go stratospheric when these tunes were being written, or was it just as much a shock to you?
No, in a word. Yeah. I mean, every band member that's ever been wants their band to be stratospheric. Of course they do. That's what every single band member wants. They'd be lying if they said, no, I'm not that bothered about success. I just want to kind of play a little bit. And as long as nobody hears it, I'll be happy. No, you want it to do as well as possible. I don't think any of us envisaged that it would be as big as it was. And as quick. I mean, it was meteoric. It was just like, it was exactly as you said it there, Danny. It was going from just rehearsing in a room to then playing a gig, to then playing a few more gigs and then being on Top of the Pops. It was, and then doing an album. And it was like, whoa, hold on a minute. And having like a number one album. It was very, very, very quick. It was something that, again, I don't think any of us expected it to be that quick. I think, especially when we heard Hand in Glove, when I heard Hand in Glove, it's the first time that the Smiths had ever been heard by the Smiths, because in the rehearsal room, you never get a true indication of what it's going to sound like. I mean, all I could hear was boom, ka boom, boom, ka boom, ka 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 boom, ka ka ka. And of course, Andy's just going to hear doo 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 doo. And Morrissey probably couldn't hear anything. So when you actually sit down in a recording studio and then you listen to it, there's an overdub on there, there's a harmonica overdub as well. And then when you listen to it with that clarity, and I thought, my goodness, what is this? This sounds pretty good and very different, but very traditional in the lineup. But I remember saying to a mate of mine, he said, you know, how's it going with that band? And I said, oh, we sound great. I said, you know what? We could even be as big as the Psychedelic Furs. Mm-hmm. And he was like, nah. No chance. And I said, honestly, I think we could even be as big as that. So that's where my kind of, that's where my benchmark was set. Because the Psychedelic Furs was super cool. You couldn't really kind of get a cooler band. Not massively successful, but very cool. And it was me kind of thinking, wow, you know, one day we could even be as big as them. So there, in that kind of sentence there in 1983, when I said that, I knew we were going to be successful. But, I mean, here we are, you know, 35, 40 years later, talking about that was in. It was quick. It was a very quick transition from having a rehearsal in a room to being on Top of the Pops.
I want to pick up on Top of the Pops a little bit as well, because for my generation, the generation below, it's got all this more almost like a mythical sort of feel to it, because it sort of stopped in, 2006? So we grew up with it a little bit, but it wasn't the programme that it was in the 80s and the 90s. Mm-hmm. What was it like for you going on Top of the Pops on that first hour? What was it like going down on that road down to London?
Well, it was huge, because, like you said there, you touched upon it, the fact that, you know, Top of the Pops and the Old Grey Whistle Test were the only two things, really, on TV. That was it. Obviously, you couldn't just go on the internet and have a look at a band in a rehearsal situation, or watching them in a live recording from a radio session, or a small TV company setting up in a room with the band in a rehearsal room. You know, you can do that pretty much for pennies now. But Top of the Pops, I think, well, I mean, the biggest artists in the world had been on Top of the Pops. Biggest artists ever. It doesn't get any bigger. It didn't get any bigger. And the kudos of being on that, that was a pinnacle of anybody's career to appear on Top of the Pops, because it wasn't, you know, like I said to you, oh, we've got, you know, some TV, there's 20 TVs that you're going to be doing in the UK that, you know, in the next couple of weeks. No, it was Top of the Pops was the one. And when we went down there, I think like a lot of bands, we kind of felt, well, I mean, the Smiths felt a little bit out of place, because a lot of the bands that were there, they kind of dressed up in all the finery, like a pantomime, some of them, you know, I mean, some of these bands there, and it was like, blimey, why are you wearing that? And I think they looked at us and probably thought the same thing, you know. I mean, I had a pair of jeans on and a jumper. I remember, in fact, there was one girl that came up to me in the green room. She said, are you on the TV? Are you playing, or are you working with the band? And I said, yeah, I'm going on. And she was like, oh, really, what band are you in? I said, I'm at a band called The Smiths. And she was like, oh, right, so when are you going on? I said, I'm going straight through now, I've had this brew. And she said, when are you going to get changed? No. And I said, what do you mean get changed? And she said, well, you can't go and tell it like that. And I was like, what? And she said, what, jeans and a T-shirt? Expecting us, you know, to have like look like Paul Young, where, you know, to get through the door, he had to go through sideways because he had this huge jacket on and everything. And we would just have like a shirt and a pair of jeans, you know, thought the music, let the music kind of speak for itself. You know, I love that aspect of it.
Oh, I love that. I love the idea. You'd have to go in and get you. The BBC will pull you out some clothes to like, oh, would this one be all right? We've got some of this.
Yeah, yeah. Where's my feather boa? You know? And that's kind of, because I remember it was Spandau Ballet that were on, and they came over to our stage, because everybody's sitting on, you're sitting on your individual stages. There's five or six stages in the studio. And, you know, they came over to us, very civil. You know, we said hello, they said hello to us. And they come over with leather and bullet belts and everything. Mike Max, you know. I was looking at them thinking, why are you wearing that? What are you wearing that for? And kind of, I think they looked at us and kind of thought, God, look at the state of them. Where's your bullet belt? Kind of. And I was a bit kind of like nonplussed as to why you want to dress up like that. You know, what is it? Some kind of fancy dress party. But, you know, it's one of those things where, you know, that's where the Smiths differed, I suppose.
Exactly. And so what I've always been fascinated about is the dynamic between the four of you. It seemed like there were different personalities in the band, but what was it like when you were sort of on tour, on the buses, rehearsing, or what was the relationship like between the four of you?
Fun.
Yeah.
Well, it was. It was, I mean, Andy is, I mean, we had our own Eric Morecambe, really, with Andy. It was relentless. It really was. It was just from the moment he woke up to the moment he went to bed, you know, he was just a funny guy. Morrissey, very kind of caustic wit, very funny as well. You know, people say, oh, the Smiths miserable. No, very, very funny bloke, incredibly dry. And I think, you know, that's that, maybe that Mancunian thing, you know. Me and Andy and Johnny, really, were the kind of, I wouldn't say the engine of the band. Well, I suppose we were. People tend to forget, you know, the group was the four of us, but the band was just three of us. That was me and Andy and Johnny. We were the people playing the instruments. Of course, a voice is an instrument, you know, don't get me wrong there, but in terms of the hardware, and we were creating the music for Morrissey to use his voice, his instrument over the top. But in terms of the camaraderie between us, it was very strong, the bond. We saw each other every day for 4 years, 5 years. And I mean every day. I don't mean let's meet up on Saturday for rehearsals. We saw each other every day, even when we weren't playing and we weren't doing anything. We were writing and hanging out and just being mates. So there's a lot of camaraderie. It was a very insular kind of closed shop when we went on tour, when we did anything together. We huddled together and stuck together when we went abroad. You know, we kind of stayed together for protection. I don't mean physically, I just meant in terms of, you know, we were in this together. And that's where the bond came from, really, is just seeing each other every single day for years and years and years, going through the highs and the lows. And the thing is, you know, when you're doing that, it's very difficult for anybody from the outside to come in because they're not experiencing it. So they can't say, oh, I know what you mean, or, oh, I've had that, or, yeah, that's an issue that I've dealt with, because they haven't, and you become quite insular. And it was like that when I was coming home off tour and out of the studio, got to see my mates and stuff. I felt pretty detached from a lot of people because what I was doing was pretty unique, and I couldn't really explain what it was like to people. I didn't want to explain to people because I couldn't put it into words what it was like. You know, what's it like on tour? Great. I didn't want to sit them down and explain to them just kind of, because sometimes, you know, it's not just the hour on the stage. There's another 23 hours, you know, and those 23 hours, you're with these people all the time. So there's got to be a bond there. Otherwise, you'd go mad.
Mm, totally. And what I wanted to look at as well is the creative process of it, because three-piece melody and the really punchy drums you're bringing to the table as well for a lot of tracks. Yeah, can you tell us what it was like when new tracks were sort of made for the Smiths? I imagine it was sort of maybe different every time or something like that, but can you give us a bit of a flavour of what it was like when these tracks were being made?
Yeah, it was pretty much different every time. The first album was just Get in the Room, and Johnny would play the riff and then we'd just play it, knock it around, and that's how the first album came about. Then Johnny, I had a Drumatics, a little tiny little drum machine, and I mean, it's just boom, dip, boom, dip, boom, dip, and that was it. And then Johnny used that to write with it. So sometimes he'd just want to be able to play it with something as a reference, really. And it stayed the same. He wouldn't change the drum part for the choruses or anything. It pretty much stayed the same for the whole idea that he wanted to put down. And it'd give me an indication of where he saw it. Because sometimes when somebody gives you a guitar line, riff, then you can, drummers, you know, you can do anything with it, really, trying to find the right one. And sometimes a songwriter will say, well, I never even thought of a drum part like that. I didn't see it like that. And so sometimes it would be, I'd use that as a reference. I think, well, is that what he wants? Or is that just because it was the drum beat? Because sometimes you just turn it on and it was whatever the drum beat was that he'd play along to. But in terms of the, like I said, the writing, the one notable thing that does stick out is that it was with Morrissey, and especially later on, sometimes we wouldn't hear the vocal at all. Morrissey would, in the studio, would be sitting there kind of working out the tune, working out the arrangement, working out the just kind of how this is going to be constructed. And then we'd go in there and we'd put down a rough idea, and then we'd listen back to it and be thinking, no, maybe that should be like that, or this should be like this, and slight differences. And then Morrissey would take a copy of that, and then, you know, because a lot of the time, if we were staying in a residential studio, then he'd go back to his room and listen to it, or if we weren't, and he'd go back to the hotel, go back to his house in Kensington or whatever, and listen back to it, and right then. Most of the time, we'd have the track pretty much finished. It wouldn't be mixed, but the track in its drums, bass, guitar would be done. And Morrissey would go in and put the vocal down for the first time. And that's when the first time that we'd hear it. And what an experience that was, trust me.
That sounds mega, does that?
It is, because, you know, I'm hearing the song for the very first time live. And yeah, the thing is, you know, he'd never come in with a few scrappy ideas. He'd never come in and think, he'd say, right, I've got a verse, I'm just going to sing the verse, I won't sing the chorus, or I've got a great chorus line, I'm not too sure how it'll go. He'd just come in and go, okay, right, I'm ready. And we get a vocal sound and get it nice and clear. And then he'd just sing the song. And it was just, I mean, there's a couple of instances. I remember when he sang I Know It's Over. And I mean, what's the first line of that? Oh, mother, I can feel the soil falling over my head. And it was just, hold on a minute. Whoa. And yeah, I mean, a lot of the time we were just hearing it for the first time, and what an experience that was to hear. Because like I said, he never scrapped vocals. He never said, no, I'm not sure about that. We'll come back to that one. Or I'll live with that one for a few days. I've come up with a different idea or a different... No, that prolific that he could just write the words for that song, go in and perform them. And that was... That's incredible. That I've never worked with anybody that's done that before, and I probably will never work with anybody that can do that since, because that's a very unusual way to do your vocal, to just kind of write them, finish them, perform them, and that's it, recorded.
Wow. It's outstanding. It's blown my mind, so I'm going to have to put another tune on. Well, I'll try and take some. I've got Hand in Glove. We've got the very first one. We'll go for that one.
This is BFBS. The Forces Station.
The story of the Smiths.
So I never managed to get a chance to see the Smiths, but from what I've looked at the comments and some of the YouTube videos and some of the gigs that you did, the few and far between being able to have a look at some of them, but it seems quite reciprocal. It's a bit of give and take is what I'm getting at. You know, it seemed like there was a real connection between the audience and the band. What was it like playing live when you had that sort of that experience?
Well, you know, you just kind of so succinctly described what it was like playing live with the Smiths. That's exactly what it was like. I think if there was a barrier there when we played gigs, obviously if it's a festival, you can't really do that. But our own gigs, it had to be removed because we wanted to be able to have that connection with the audience. And when there's 12 feet between you and the front row, it's impossible to do. So we got rid of the barriers. The only reason why we were up on the stage wasn't because our egos were exalted and we were higher or better than those people. It's so that people could see better. That was the only reason. And that's what we got excited when people got excited. And like you said, it's reciprocated. And it just became this maelstrom of energy because when people were going for it, we were going for it. And then they'd go for it more and we'd go for it more. And it was such a fantastic experience. Been to see some bands and it's kind of, I wouldn't say they're going through the motions, but I don't know, for me it was pretty much a religious experience being on stage. It was absolutely wonderful and exciting and terrifying and amazing and unreal, because it's just it's a very unusual situation to be in, to kind of express yourself through your instrument and seeing people crying. When looking at that front row, because I had the best seat in the house, because I saw the band and the crowd. So I was quite lucky in that respect. But the view, playing with the Smiths and seeing the reactions of what we were putting out from the stage was absolutely priceless. Yeah, I remember we played up in Glasgow. It'd probably be 84, because it was one of the early gigs. I remember when we played up there, we played Hand in Glove. I think it was the first track, actually, that we played, first song we played live. And the audience was singing louder than the PA. And Johnny turned around and looked at me with his mouth open, just, my God. And I was just, I couldn't believe it. Because I was thinking, wow, you know, we're up in Scotland. Couldn't be any further away from Manchester in the UK. And they know the words. So obviously it was early doors when that happened. But the adrenaline that's coursing through your veins when you're kind of getting that kind of reaction and people are singing back to you the song that you're playing to them, like I said, louder than the PA. Nothing beats that. Nothing beats it. Because really, you know, we're quite selfish with each other, because in a rehearsal room or in the studio, I'm not bothered about how it sounds on record. I'm not bothered about the success of the record. I'm not bothered about whether it's chart position. I'm bothered about impressing Andy and Johnny and Morrissey. That's what I was doing. That's the only thing that I was interested in doing. And I think they were doing the same thing as well. As long as, you know, the rest of the band were impressed and it was like, wow, sounds great, that. It's like, yes, bingo. Mm-hmm. And that's what we were trying to do. But when you're taken out into a live situation, it's kind of off the leash. Especially when you do a track and it sounds absolutely fantastic. The audience are absolutely loving it. Because at the end of a lot of Smith's tracks, there was always, because I mean, I played so many gigs with so many other bands as well, that I can tell what a sound of applause is. It's never the same. It's always different. There's always something that's slightly different about it. Sometimes it can be polite applause. Sometimes it can be, you know, appreciative. But with the Smiths, most of the time, there'd always be this like, nth of a second, a hundredth of a second, or whatever, as soon as we finish, bam, 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 and there'd be this kind of silence of what, and then way, and then there's this massive kind of applause. And it doesn't happen with a lot of bands that I played with. I think just because it was quite shocking to hear what we were doing, you know, and people were kind of bowled over by it, really, I suppose. And I felt that, and we all felt that, and that's why we had such a great time doing it.
I've got to ask you this question. I imagine you've been asked it a million times, just because of how passionately you speak about being live. Would you want to do all that sort of thing again?
I don't think so. I don't think so, no. You were saying before how young we were, you know, it was just four kids. Four kids. I mean, my youngest is older than all four of us were when we split up. That's some age that, you know, when we were kids and what we were doing when we were kids, and that bond that we had is gone. That's just because of A, because of time, and B, we're different people. So I'm not too sure whether, I mean, we could recreate it sound-wise. That wouldn't be a problem. We could never recreate the bond that we had. And I'm not too sure whether any of us want to go and try and recreate something that you can't.
Yeah, that's something that I was thinking about, like not even sort of like a reunion, but even more like sort of on a friendship level, sort of along those lines.
Yeah, well, that's what I'm saying. I don't know these guys anymore, and they don't know me. I mean, I work with, you know, Sinead O'Connor, with Buzzcocks, with Johnny Rotten, Public Image. I don't speak to these people, you know. I was working with them, and it was great, and we had a great time doing it. You know, the bond that we had was stronger than your average band, I think, of, like I said, just meeting up once a week for rehearsals and then going in the studio and then having a couple of weeks off before we went on tour. It was every single day, and to try and renew that, it can't be done, I don't think, just because, like I said, it was 40 years ago. You know, we're just very different people. We don't really know each other. And that was the beauty of what we had when we were working together, is that bond was so strong that it came out in the music, I think.
Hmm. When you say from a sound point of view, I was thinking, because I've actually been to see them, maybe some sort of ABBA Voyage style with the Smiths. Would you up for something like that?
Now you're just getting weird, Danny. Yeah. How about Mannequins?
Worth a try and get it all together.
Projected onto the mannequin. And then we can do that. And then you can have the music on the speaker.
Oh, man.
The Smiths tribute bands out there, that sounds super.
35 years since the Strange Ways album. What's your favourite one from that one that we'll give a play? Is it like picking between children, this one? Is it a tough choice?
No, it's not actually, because Last Night I Dreamt is probably one of my favourite songs by the group, never mind from this album. In terms of what you'd expect from a so-called indie band, in inverted commas, around that time, this certainly wasn't it.
Life.
The Forces Station.
The story of the Smiths.
Each generation falling in love with the Smiths. I did. I didn't until I went to university of all places. I'd heard the Smiths, but I'd not listened to the Smiths. I think there's that difference at the time when someone first introduced me to it. And I think there's been that with the generation below. You know, I was going into a record shop in Leeds. I was picking up the records, talking to the bloke behind the counter. And I was on about Smiths. He said it's the most popular one as well because the sleeves are so beautiful from the albums that were brought out, you know.
Yes.
Why do you think there's each generation falls in love with the Smiths? Could you pinpoint it, do you think?
Well, you hit on one aspect of it there with the sleeves. You sound pretty timeless. That's why, you know, because if we were a skiffle band or a kind of a punk band, then we would have had a time and a moment. And, okay, you might get a resurgence of punk sounds and skiffle bands, but in terms of rockabilly or whatever, we didn't come from any era. Although we were slap bang in the 80s, if it would have been 1964 and we wrote Hand in Glove, I think it would have got a lot of attention. If it was 2064, I think, and you heard How Soon Is Now, I think people would go, wow, what's that? And I think that's what makes us different from a lot of bands, because there was a compilation album that came out a few years ago called The Best of the 80s, and The Cure were on it, and Depeche Mode, I think, and Culture Club, Heaven 17, Duran Duran, Nick Kershaw, all the bands, you know, from in the 80s, and we weren't.
And really?
But we were bang right in the middle of the 80s.
Yeah.
But I think that shows you that we weren't an 80s sounding band, and we didn't belong in the 80s. We could have come around at any time, 70s, 90s, 2000s, and I think we would have been pretty relevant. And I think that's why we don't date. My next door neighbour, the young lad there, the son, he's a bit of a Smiths fan, and, you know, he's about 12, 11, 12, and I can't see that happening with, I don't know, a certain kind of 80s bands. I'm not saying it doesn't happen, of course it happens, but what I'm saying is, we didn't sound 80s at all. And I think that's what probably the appeal is. But also, I mean, with lyrical content like that, you are going to stand out. And obviously, you just mentioned there, Danny, about the sleeves. The whole package works together so well. And people get the Smiths or they don't. And if you don't get it, it's all right, not a problem. But if you get it, you get it. And again, it's that thing about, you know, the Smiths or the dead miserable. Nah, that Morrissey is miserable. He's not. And people, if you get it, you know that he's not miserable, because he might, you know, it's just a bit of laziness, really, when people talk about, you know, heaven knows I'm miserable now and girlfriend in a coma and that kind of thing. Oh, God, a bit miserable, that. It's not. It's tongue-in-cheek. It's called humour. And obviously some of the, you know, there's dark subjects that he does cover and even meets murder, you know. But it's intelligent. That's what it is. And like I said, if you get it, you get it. And if you don't, that's cool. But there's definitely that element to what we do, because even in the 80s when we were at our peak, there's a lot of people that didn't understand it, didn't like it, you know, and that's fair enough. I haven't got a problem with that, but the fact is that they didn't really get it. If you don't like the music, you don't like the music. It doesn't matter what lyrics are on it. But in terms of, you know, what the appeal is for the next generation, I do think that we sound pretty timeless. I think there was a level of honesty with the Smiths. It was pretty much, this is it and this is what you get. No histrionics, no big expensive videos to kind of try and not fool the public, but try and convince the public that this is a fantastic thing. It was just pretty much honest kind of musicianship and lyric writing. And yeah, like, I mean, you mentioned it earlier, you know, I mean, Johnny Marr's a phenomenal writer. So that always helps.
I love the way he's still managed as well after all these years to keep that cool image.
I don't think it comes as easy to him as it does his guitar playing, because he's always been into his fashion. I think probably, I didn't know him when he was at school, but, you know, I've seen photographs of him when he was at school and he was just painfully cool. And that's something that, because I remember he had these trousers and he'd cut them up the side just where the stitching was and have like a little V shape. So to go over his moccasins. And I was like, wow, that looks so cool. And it's obviously some photograph that he's probably seen Brian Jones doing it, or I don't know, somebody really cool from the 60s, and he's kind of copied that. But yeah, he's worked very hard on his image, does Johnny, and it shows, because he always looked painfully cool, always.
It's the sort of thing, if the lads saw me doing that at the pub, they'd go, what are you doing, Dally? What are you doing? What are you playing at?
Yeah, I know, I know. Well, I remember because he'd do that with his hair. He'd change his barnet, you know, go from like a massive quip and then into like a virtually a skinhead, like a suede. And it always looked really good, not like, what have you done? It would never work like that. It was always like, wow, that looks really cool. No matter what he did, and I think, you know, these decisions were, it wasn't just flipping, oh, I know what I'll do, I'll just do this. I think there was a lot of kind of styling going on inside his head and intensity about how this will work. And same with his clobber, you know, I mean, anything that he did. Johnny never threw on a T-shirt. Johnny never threw on a jacket. He never threw on a pair of shoes. He was kind of meticulous in his garb and what he wore and what was working with him. And the same with the colour of his guitars, everything, and the finish. And I mean, it's, yeah, it probably does come easy to him. Drives me mad.
I know what you mean.
Well, you know, when he works at the shop in X-Clothes in Manchester, I told you, I went in there and I was a punk and I saw this mohair jumper, but it was the one where it was very brightly coloured. I think it was like probably yellow and red and orange and like kind of in bar colours across the top. And then I picked it up and I was like, oh, that looks so cool. And I kind of looked and Johnny was standing at the counter, you know, kind of taking money from people who was working behind the till. And I looked at it and I looked at it and I thought, I don't have the bottle to actually take it up to this guy. And I didn't even know him, but I didn't have the bottle to kind of go up and say, like this, please. Because I thought he'd just go, you're buying that? Is that for you? And I wanted to put it back and walked out.
BFBS, original music specials. The story of the Smiths.
So looking back at Strange Ways,
the difficulty wasn't in the recording because it's Morrissey's favourite album, so I've heard, and likewise with Johnny and Andy and mine. So it can't have been that bad. I think the intensity of the band always was growing from the first day that we met until the last day that we said our goodbyes. And that's healthy. I think that's healthy for a working environment. You know, sometimes depending on who's at the wheel, you know, it can be, you know, they can feel it a lot differently in terms of writing. I'm talking about Johnny here, really. You know, I mean, obviously, if he felt as though the time had come in terms of what he'd created by being the songwriter in the Smiths, and he thought that it was, you know, it was over. Nobody really knows, you know. I never asked him when he told me and Andy that he wanted to leave. We were kind of bewildered, really, by that decision. But at the time, I thought it was the wrong decision. But you can't tell somebody that's made their mind up either way that it's right or wrong, you know, which is naive of me to think that, you know, it's like, oh, that's not the right decision. It's like, well, actually, it is, you know, because it's my decision, not yours. From my perspective, it was the wrong decision. That's where I think... semantics, but it means a lot, you know, in terms of whether it was the right decision. I thought it was the wrong decision. You know, it wasn't the wrong decision because it was the right decision for Johnny. Yeah, it was tough, but, you know, what a way to go out.
When something so big and something that's been part of your life for so long sort of comes to an end.
Yeah, well, I was lucky because I had the situation where one quarter of what I adored was taken away from me and then I had three quarters left. So that's what I did. Myself and Andy and Morrissey stayed together, albeit a brief period, but we did some more recording together. And that I felt comfortable doing that at the time because, like I said, you know, I still kind of thought Morrissey was singing better than ever and his bass playing was absolutely fantastic. Craig Gannon, good mate of ours, and great guitarist was involved. Stephen Street was still on board, the producer. So it wasn't as though everything was split and taken away from me. I carried on with those other guys. Again, I'm really happy with what we did, but maybe I was just clinging on to something that we should have just had a break. I don't know. I don't mean a break. I mean, kind of for me to say, right, let's start fresh. But I've got absolutely no qualms about what I did post-Smiths with those guys. It sounds fantastic. I love those singles that we brought out. Obviously, there's other tracks on it. I think trying to carry on with the same band, yeah, without Johnny, because, of course, he was the main songwriter. It's very difficult to carry on with... It wasn't even just one band member. It was three quarters of us. So, you know, maybe... and although it was going under the name Morrissey, it wasn't the Smiths. It kind of was the Smiths, but without Johnny, and that's not the Smiths.
Double Decker Bus crashes into us. To die by your side, such a heavenly way to die. It's just these constant punchy lyrics. Well, you know, what are your memories of that sort of track?
Yeah, it was every single one was just out of this world. And, you know, it's the kind of thing, the rhythm that Morrissey would adopt, depending on the song that he was singing, is very important. You know, obviously the lyrical content is out of this world. Take, for example, Meet His Murderer. You know, I became vegetarian the day we recorded that.
Really?
We were talking about it, and Morrissey, obviously being a vegetarian himself, was arguing the case for vegetarianism, and I was going, oh, no, I really enjoy eating meat, and it's fantastic. And, you know, his argument was the cruelty aspect, and I had no argument against that. And I became vegetarian on that day in 1985, and I've been vegetarian ever since. All my children were brought up vegetarians, grandkids brought up vegetarians, and that's the power of the lyric, you know, and you know, not only the content, but like I said, the rhythm of his singing is always interesting and always absolutely spot on. And I mean, the way that he stretches, you know, the words as well. I'm talking about other things than the obvious things there, Danny, you know, because obviously, you know, that couplet that you just kind of sang there, that was written, because I've seen it tattooed on people's arms and stuff, you know, that kind of, you just have that on a T-shirt, because it kind of sets it up. It kind of explains just how much one feels about somebody else. Mm. You can't argue with it. You can't say, oh, well, you know, did you really like them then? but tell us really how precious they were to you. It's just, that's it. And that's what Morrissey does. He can write, because he's a poet, you know, but he sings his poetry. And that's probably what separates Morrissey from the vast majority of singers that are around, rather than singing the lyrical content not being of that much importance, and more about how great the voice is sounding. You know, he's got a great voice to start off with, that's a given. But in terms of his the lyrical content, it's out there. It's out there. And he did that, like I said, from Hand in Glove to Strange Ways.
Oh, well, Mike, it's been a pleasure. Thank you so much for joining on this Smiths Music Special today.
Cheers, Danny. Nice one, mate.
Take me out tonight, where there's music and there's people and the young and the light. Driving in your car, I never want to go home, because I haven't got one anymore. Take me out, because I want to see people and I want to see life. Driving in your car, oh please don't drop me home, because it's not my home, it's their home, and I'm welcome no more. If a double-decker bus crashes into us, to die by your side is such a heavenly way to die. And if a ten-ton truck kills the both of us, to die by your side, well, the pleasure, the privilege is mine. Take a strange fear gripped me and I just couldn't ask. Take me out tonight. Oh, take me anywhere, don't care. Driving in your car, I never want to go home, because I haven't. And
On air, online, on the app, on FM, and DAB Plus throughout the UK. This is BFBS. The Forces Station.